Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the audio version of the ultimate football news service from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Matt Dickinson, Rory K. Smith, and broadcasting from beautiful downtown Rippendon, it's Ollie Kay. Later on, we'll be discussing the transfer window. But first, how about Liverpool and City? A 2-2 draw. Ollie, I guess we can start with City, but we really should start with Liverpool. Is this the answer that Brendan Rodgers was supposed to be giving?
I think it's the first part of the response, to the question. I thought Liverpool played very well. I mean, the middle sort of 50 minutes of the game, I thought they looked very much in control, and I thought it was unfortunate that the Skrtel error was came when it did. From Liverpool's point of view, they were playing very well. Joe Allen was passing the ball brilliantly in midfield, and I just thought that there was a fluency and a fluidity and a rhythm to Liverpool that I think will delight Rodgers. I think they're very much a work in progress, and it will remain so all season. But I thought that was very positive.
Dicko, is it clear to you now what Brendan's trying to do?
Well, like Ollie, I mean, certainly was as a first home statement. I thought so. Yeah, I mean, just in Joe Allen, to be honest, just in that performance alone, I thought we saw Rodgers firmly sort of setting out his template, his idea, and a very exciting one it is. If I was a Liverpool fan, despite the self-inflicted mistakes of yesterday, I'd have left very hopeful, very confident that everything I'd heard about Rodgers, everything I hoped Rodgers could achieve could come to pass. I mean, it's not going to be simple. There's still, for him to impose his ideas, he needs a certain type of player. And he's not got that in every position, I'm sure, that he would like. But, I thought it was extremely positive start.
Rory, are you going to rain on Brendan's parade?
No, I think that it's... Liverpool always play relatively well against the big sides at Anfield. You very rarely see a City or a United or an Arsenal or a Chelsea go to Anfield, and it happens occasionally. Chelsea won 4-1 there a few years ago, but very rarely do big teams go to a sort of revved up Anfield.
Who was the manager then?
That was the noted genius Rafael Benitez was the manager then. His memoir is available in Aldwood Bookshop September the 13th. But the test for Liverpool is more whether they can get points, get results against the lesser sides. Liverpool, when they're up for it, are always fine. They're not world beaters necessarily, but they very rarely get beaten at Anfield by the big teams. I think the problem is much more whether they can produce against the Stokes and the West Broms and those sorts of sides.
Okay, so Roy didn't really learn too much then from this game, because they always perform well against big teams. Is that what you're saying?
They don't always perform well, but it's at an Anfield where everybody, where the atmosphere is sort of high octane, you're not going to learn that many lessons. Liverpool at home to City, you will not learn as much as you would at Liverpool away at Stoke. I think that of Liverpool's five opening games, that's the really crucial one.
Ollie, do you buy this? Because I can see where Rory's coming from, and I thought, I was incredibly impressed by Raheem Sterling, which I think we should get to. Is it a case that Raheem Sterling, Joe Allen, those guys, instead of being intimidated by the cop and the responsibility of playing at Anfield, actually get a lift from it? Do you buy into all that psycho babble, or are you more nuts and bolts?
No, I I do buy into the psychobabble, and I think Liverpool have seen an awful lot of players go there with big-ish reputations, or at least big-ish fees, in recent years, and you could probably take that back 20 years. And a lot of them have seemed to struggle in the atmosphere that, you know, well, struggle at Anfield, struggle with being a Liverpool player, and just not fitted in. I think Rodgers, one of the great words he uses is arrogance. He looks for arrogance in his players. Now, he's not talking about people walking up to buskers and burning £20 notes in their face. I think he's talking about... He's talking
about... That would be my definition of arrogance.
Well, it's definitely the most arrogant thing. He's talking about arrogance and confidence on the ball to play on their terms, to take the fight to the opposition. I think that's what he looks for. And I thought in the younger players, not just Sterling, not just Allen, but Barini as well. I thought Quattes was as decent as I've seen him. And Kelly had his moments at both ends, but I think that's what he's looking for. He's looking for players who are confident, not necessarily big name players, not necessarily big reputations or big price tags. He's looking for players who are confident to play his way.
I think it's what Fergie always said, isn't it, about the greatest courage in football isn't the 50-50 tackle. It's the willingness to take the ball under pressure, and that's what Joe Allen has been signed to do, and was rightly lauded by his manager yesterday. I mean, I would go so far as to say, in the Joe Allen signing, followed by the Joe Allen performance, we saw enough indication for why Dalglish had to go and Rodgers had to come in. Simple as that.
To me, Charlie Adam is the typical British footballer of 15 years ago, and Joe Allen is the typical British footballer of 15 years in the future if everything goes right. I think that's quite a nice difference.
Oh, he's good, isn't he?
In the emphasis of play. I think Dalglish's side, for all that they had massive flaws last season, I'm not defending Dalglish, it was absolutely the right decision to get rid of him. Dalglish's side played nice football, particularly at Anfield, which is what I mean, that Liverpool at Anfield, that's not the problem. The problem for Liverpool for years has been getting results against the smaller sides. I think what's crucial to remember about yesterday was just how young that side was. Kelly, Coates, Shelvey, who came on for Lucas, Allen, Suarez, Barini, Sterling, they're all, I think the average age of half the team, part of the average age was 23, which is ridiculously young.
Say half of the average age.
I think if you take out a couple of the players.
If you choose the five youngest guys, you choose their average. Yeah, okay,
if you deliberately fix the survey. Right. But it was a very young side, and I think that's important to remember as well.
Let's talk about another young player who's coming in, albeit a signing that I don't understand whatsoever, and that's Nuri Sahin. Now, for those who aren't Euro football snobs like myself and Roy, 2 years ago, Nuri Sahin was at Borussia Dortmund, where he was the best player in the Bundesliga, central midfielder, spreading the ball around, dominant, had Kagawa in front of him, had Bender behind him, looked brilliant, moves to Real Madrid and does absolutely nothing. Can't get a game, has some injuries, but probably not enough injuries to explain why the guy hardly played at all for Real Madrid. And from what I can tell, his best asset is he's a very creative passer of the ball. He's not uber dynamic. He's not uber quick. I don't see why you need Nuri Sahin if you have Joe Allen in your midfield. And he's also definitely not a holding player, so I'm assuming Lucas is going to have to start too. And then your third spot, I would assume, is going to be Stevie G. Ollie, can you explain the thinking?
Well, I would think they probably feel that they need an alternative to Gerrard, because I think if you look at Gerrard's stats the last 3-4 seasons, he's not played an awful lot of games.
He's played a lot more than Nuri Sahin last season.
Yeah, but maybe Sahin will play more this season than he did last season, and maybe Gerrard won't play as much as Sahin did at Dortmund. I can see questions with regard to the structure of the deal if they haven't got an option to sign him permanently, and it's a reasonable outlay to get him on loan. But I think the signing makes sense because although he does have a lot of central midfielders, he's clearly not convinced by Spearing or Adam or Henderson, and I think we'll see those players maybe phased out, or maybe Henderson go on loan or something, and Shaheen will play a lot of games. I'm sure he will.
Dicko, if, I mean, obviously, Shaheen, what happened to Shaheen last season remains a mystery, right? And everybody's tight-lipped about what went wrong. I mean, what kind of sort of background check would a club do on a player to see exactly what happened?
Yeah, I mean the risk is minimal, as you said. You know, that as Ollie quite rightly says, you know, Rodgers clearly is not happy with an awful lot of, you know, however many midfield players he's got. Clearly, he's not convinced that many of them suit a style that he is absolutely determined to impose, and that he's been bought in to impose. So I don't really see. I think you're getting unduly worried, Gab, on their behalf.
Let's get back on this one on a future podcast, or maybe a pint down the pub. All right, now I'm interested. Now we've got to move on to City, but I'm interested because I think we may have two divergent viewpoints between Dicko and Ollie. And so, Rory, you and I are going to be sort of the arbiters here of these two footballing heavyweights. Now, Dicko, you. Clearly said. You said Mancini was tinkering, and I think it's fair to say you were not best pleased with his with some of his choices in terms of formation and perhaps some of his substitutions as well, and certainly his personnel choices. Now, you wrote a very eloquent column about this in The Game today. Ollie, you're going to defend Mancini, right?
I'm not going to defend him hugely. I don't think the system, the 3-4-1-2, as I would see it, I don't think that is a problem. I think it's a system that suits City's squad or suits their current personnel. I think if they end up getting a winger or two this week, then maybe it won't suit the squad that they've got. But I think that system worked very well against Chelsea in the Community Shield. I think it suits a lot of the players they've got, and I thought the one problem that they really had yesterday was Carlo Torre. I don't understand why he was playing. If it was a shop window selection, it wasn't exactly a shop window performance, was it?
Dicko, though, if playing 3-4-1-2 means that I have to play Carlo Torre and Milner and Kolarov, none of whom are particularly good, can I say that, or have looked particularly wonderful, not to mention Nigel de Jong, another guy I've been trying to flog all summer, then should I maybe be playing a different system, one that maybe lets Lescott and Silva and my good players onto the pitch?
Well, it was so hard to fathom. That's why some of us were wondering yesterday if he'd done it as out of some sort of spite type, you know, bolshiness to, you know, if I put enough sort of players in slightly strange positions, then maybe it will prove to Marwood sitting in the director's box that, give me weight to my argument that I need to revamp the squad more in the next 4 days. You're struggling for some explanation because the personnel didn't make any sense in some of the positions. They were. You had Lescott on the bench, and then Zabaleta as a left-sided centre half. Carlo Torre, sort of say, brought back from nowhere. You had effectively Zabaleta and Kolarov sort of doubling up on Barini. You had Torre and Milner sort of passing Sterling around. You know, whoever good he was, sort of doubling up on a 17-year-old debutant, effectively because the wing backs weren't getting forward. So I've got no objection to 3-4-1-2 in theory and principle. I'm not sure it was that good against in the Community Shield. I mean, Chelsea were reduced to 10 men, but I can understand why Mancini wants to tinker. He wants to experiment. He wants to look at different options. You know, they're going to face. He doesn't like orthodox wingers, so playing that system has some merit with the players he's got and the type of player he's developing. You know, I've got no problem with experimenting. It just didn't make any sense with the way they did it at Liverpool against a Liverpool team that were very nervous in the first 15 minutes, are still trying to learn to play their way out of the back. It made far more sense to press high up the field as West Brom did. It didn't make sense for the occasion. It didn't make sense for the manpower. Simple as that.
I can see why Mancini wants to play that way, but I just don't think that. It's odd to me that you've got all those great players at City, and yet the one you're choosing to build the system around is James Milner.
Chelsea and Newcastle. Now, a good friend of ours at the Times, who used to be on this podcast and contributes, Guillaume Balaguer, sent out a tweet to his zillions of followers and said, "See, Torres is back. All you critics were short-sighted." Now, I haven't abused him for it yet, but I just wanted to point out that Torres's bad spell of form wasn't just a couple of months or even a year. It was a heck of a long, long time. And also a good performance and a well-taken goal doesn't really mean that he's fully back, does it, Dicko?
Well, he's not fully back, and I'm not sure he'll ever be fully back to the player he was of a few years ago. So, you know, partly by virtue of age and a wearying body. But you know, I have to say, chapeau to Torres for the fact that he's looking like he's showing the confidence of old. There's no dispute in that, and you know, I think who wouldn't be pleased to see that? I mean, I think you know, no one likes to see a player. I mean, I can still hear the gasp of 70,000 fans when he shanked that one at Old Trafford in front of the Stretford end. You know, it was just one of those sort of, you know, excruciating moments that you could see it. He was a world-class player, clean through, and he couldn't kick a ball straight 8 yards into an empty net. And you know, we winced at that, and it's great to see great players, and Torres has undoubtedly been a great player, you know, coming back to some sort of form and confidence. And you know, Chelsea, because the one interesting, you know, they spent all this money on those, you know, on an awful lot of lovely players who can play sort of, you know, across the three just behind an attacker. And they don't have an obvious deputy for Torres. I mean, Sturridge could go up front, but Chelsea have never or hardly ever played him as a sort of number nine, and certainly not as a sort of lone number nine. They need Torres to work, unless they're going to pull a striker out of nowhere in the next 4 days. So there's an awful lot resting on him, but maybe it's because of that, you know, burden and expectation and the fact that Drogba's gone that he is suddenly rising in confidence. You know, I'm glad to see it because it's, you know, say, we like to see great players, you know, play great.
I would, yeah, in terms of what you said, Gab, about the sort of Torres' funk, I'd say it probably lasted 3 years between 2009 and 2012, and I think there is an element that we have mythologised the player that existed before that. He was, obviously, in his first 2 years at Liverpool, he was a fantastic sort of force of nature, flowing forward, that blonde tresses trailing behind him. I agree that he'll never hit those the heights of that form. It could actually be said, if you looked at his career, that that form was the illusion and this Torres is the real Torres. But from what I've seen of Torres this season, he looks much fitter. He looks a lot stronger. That's crucial, that he doesn't look like he's going to be shaking off the ball. That might be because he's not moping constantly. And he looks like he's got a team, as Dicko says, built for him, basically. But the problem Chelsea have is that they've been looking at Cavani, they've been looking at Falcao. They can't sign either of those strikers if they want Torres to play, because you can't go and spend, what, 35 million on Cavani, 35 million on Falcao, and then say to them, all right, lads, you're on the bench.
No, you play Cavani on the wing.
But Cavani's not nearly as effective on the wing.
Doesn't matter. Just give it a couple of weeks, Torres will stink again, and then you put Cavani in front.
That's Bob's your uncle. Very negative, but they've got the...
No, but that's your insurance plan, and if Torres does well, then, hey, Cavani, hey, you know, well, enjoy coming on.
Who'd you drop for him?
What?
Hazard, Mata, who'd you drop? Oscar?
Who do you... Well, Oscar's already dropped. I mean, it doesn't really matter who you drop. I mean, I would assume you can go really attacking and drop
John Obi-Mikel.
There you go. Drop John.
Don't have a midfield, but I think that they do have... Torres looks as good as I've seen him for probably 3 years at the moment, but that in itself gives Chelsea a problem because, as you say, there is a chance that his form will be illusory and it will disappear. And if that happens after Friday, they've not reinforced, then they've got a bit of an issue.
Ollie, I was...
Could I just say it'd be interesting? I mean, I'd love to know, and whether we'll ever find out, but whether he was... There were times when, you know, he'd straying into dangerous sort of, you know, male-esque sort of putting Torres on the couch type pieces. But, I mean, I would love... I've discussed it with people at Chelsea and never had a definitive answer of whether Torres was sort of clinically depressed at any of those stages in the last couple of years. I mean, he certainly, you know, you down in the dumps would be the understatement, to say the least. But you know, you wonder, there were times when the way he was carrying on, I don't know, say this is the danger of sort of reading into body language, but when a guy is sort of walking around in such a funk for so long, you have to ask. Say at one stage he had lapsed into full-blown depression, and I'd love to get an answer to that at some stage.
I was told the other day that one of Fernando Torres' favourite bands are the Doo Doo Dolls, so I think we can be fairly sure he's got some sort of major problem.
There you go. Leave it to you to make a musical reference, which passes me and Ollie by. Let's bring it back to football, away from silly waste of time like pop music, or indeed the Goo Goo Dolls. I think I'm right in saying Chelsea have scored 8 goals this season. Hazard has scored one of them, and on the other 7, he's either delivered the final pass or he's won the penalty for them. Anybody here have the cojones to stand up and be like, oh, I'm not surprised by how well Hazard has done. I expected him to be this good so quickly.
Maybe not so quickly. That's the surprise, I think, that he's just waltzed into the team and looked like one of the best players in the country. But I think, yeah, I think anyone who'd seen him for Lille more than, you know, 2 or 3 times had probably thought that he's obviously got something. He's obviously special. He is a world-class talent, and he's showing that. So it's not a surprise he's doing this well. You maybe wouldn't have expected it in the first 3 games, I guess.
He's got Dicko. He's got that weird thing where he's very quick and obviously skillful, but he's also got like that wide rear end where he's low to the ground and he's kind of difficult to knock off the ball. It's almost almost Tevez-esque, if I can make up that word.
You've been studying his rear end more than I have, but no, I know, take your point. I mean, he's, as you say, low center of gravity. I mean, that, as you say, makes him, and which one of the things that will equip him, I guess, for the Premier League will be the ability to be a little robust. No, I think, like Rory said, I don't think anyone is surprised by the skill, and I guess we'd all expect to see it in flashes, but it is pretty rare for a player to come in, and or not rare, but certainly, you know, it speaks very well of an exceptional player that he can come in and take to it so fast. And I have to say, Di Matteo needs to take some credit for that, I guess. I mean, I'm still waiting to be vindicated on my scepticism about Di Matteo, and it's proving I'm getting twitchy. He's won the FA Cup and the European Cup, and if I keep sticking on this, Di Matteo's not going to succeed at Chelsea, then I reckon in the next 10 years I might just be vindicated.
Want to talk Newcastle? I was impressed by them, but
tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
One thing which I thought was cruel and weird and stupid is this idea that they had to play on Thursday night in the Europa League and then travel to London on Saturday. Now, I'm told that this was because of the police and the Notting Hill Carnival, and so they couldn't play this game on Sunday. Now, far be it for me to tell you all how to run your police force, but maybe I can tell you a bit how to run your fixture calendar. Why did they schedule this game for the weekend of the Notting Hill Carnival?
What you mean, should they have wiped out all home games in London on this particular weekend, even though there's, whatever it is, 5 or 6 London teams?
Well, no, but evidently it was enough of a problem that Newcastle couldn't play on Saturday, right? So they knew Newcastle were in the Europa League, right? That wasn't a mystery?
No.
Couldn't they simply have move the fixtures or put it as a variable in their fixture computer to make sure that Newcastle wouldn't be penalised in this way?
Their entirely random fixture computer that just happens to generate four Super Sundays a year.
Stop it.
I think it's ridiculous that Newcastle were forced to play again within 48 hours. I think it's really unfair, and I don't know what the solution would be. I don't know whether it's I don't know whether it's logistically impossible to have a football match in Chelsea when the Nottingham Hill Carnival's on. But I mean, if it was, then why not play the game on the Monday night? I mean, it seemed very unfair, given that. Teams generally don't have to play twice in 48 hours. It seemed very unfair that Newcastle were forced to do that at all, never mind after a trip back from Greece.
Now on to our debate. We're basically 2 weeks into the season, and still there's transfer speculation. Unsettled players are being left out of squads. Clint Dempsey, perhaps Luka Modric, who of course is on the verge of signing for Real Madrid. I think it's subject to a medical as we record this. And there's this weird situation where perhaps fans don't know if they will start the next game with a stronger or weaker squad. Now, Rory, you always have bright ideas about how we can fix transfer systems. I believe a while back you were arguing that we should abolish transfer fees altogether, so the wealthy clubs can simply get all the good players at other clubs to just give their notice and go join them without any compensation. What's your bright solution on the transfer system?
Well, I agree that it's inherently stupid that it's sort of, yeah, 2 games into the season and clubs are still sort of buying and selling and what have you. And as you say, there's actually an argument that it interrupts the integrity of the league, because it's much better for you to face, I'm trying to think of a good example, say Sunderland without Clint Dempsey, than it is to face Sunderland with Clint Dempsey, if you take that just as an example that may not be necessarily
Does
true.
Does he play for Fulham?
Well, but say if he signs for okay. Sunderland, if you, the two teams who've played Sunderland before he signs are facing, theoretically, a weaker Sunderland team. But what I really don't understand is why clubs wait for the deadline. Surely, and I know this is true of Roberto Mancini, it's partly why he's so frustrated. Managers want players in for pre-season, because that's when they do, A, their fitness work, and B, that's when they do a lot of the shape work that lets the managers sort of get their sides working as they want them to be. And yet they seem to wait for August the 31st to do everything. It's been worse this summer than most summers. And it's completely ludicrous, because the money that you saved, as you think teams are going to panic buy your own players or panic sell their players, you're costing yourself, because you're at the same time panic selling your own players and panic buying other people's players. It's a completely ludicrous system.
Ollie, do you agree with this? Can you justify waiting till the end to get the best deals?
No, I think if you're Daniel Levy, you've probably had a few experiences where you think you've been terribly clever and got people at the last minute for $500,000 less than you might otherwise have done. And I think that there is a certain sort of type of chairman who thinks it's extremely clever, or managers think that they'll get players in the last few days of August that they might not otherwise get. But it's it just frustrates me for the reason that Rory mentioned. It's the integrity of the league, but it's also this first 2 weeks of the season almost feels like a bit of a phony war, really. It feels like, you know, teams still haven't got their squads together, and obviously it's only sort of 10 years or so since transfers used to happen all the way through to March, but it's the transfer window has created a frenzy which is concentrated in the final week of August and the final week of January. I would prefer it if that frenzy happened before the season started. I think it makes things too unstable as the season starts.
There's a compatibility with Europe, partly, isn't it? I mean, if so much of the business is international, then I guess with most of Europe having a window to the end of August, then, you know, it makes some sense to be, say, to dovetail with them.
But the same thing's happened in Spain. They're 2 games into their season. Mm. Serie A kicks off this weekend.
Yeah, but there's other leagues in Europe apart from Spain and Italy, Mr. Big League, big team.
Which leagues
and there's also leagues in
which leagues haven't started, Gab?
Haven't started yet?
Yeah. Of the major leagues, which ones haven't started?
Well, Macedonian.
The major leagues have started, but there's some leagues which start in mid-July. I mean, there's some leagues that play through the summer. There's nothing stopping the Premier League from saying, hey, look, first, you can sign players right up to until the first game of the season. After that, you can't sign anymore.
Yeah, but you,
they can make that rule.
There is something stopping them because you're hamstring your teams whilst other clubs are doing their business.
So right, but you would have that stability and integrity that you guys love talking about. But actually, Dicko, you and I are older than these kids here, right? And I think, although Ollie's got a good sense of history, so he mentioned it. A few years ago, the transfer window ran the whole year long. I remember being absolutely shocked. One of the first few years I was in this, it was in the country. And to be fair, I wasn't. It wasn't a player. It was a manager. I remember George Graham sort of managing Leeds one week and Spurs the next week, and Leeds playing Spurs in between, and thinking like, my goodness, you know, talk about unsettling and instability and potentially tapping up and all this other stuff. Surely it was a lot worse back then, and that's why the transfer window brings some order, right?
Well, when I saw we were discussing this topic, I was actually trying to wind my creaking memory back to the days when there wasn't a window, and as you say, it was sort of open season all round, and trying to recall whether that did make things less friendly. I mean, sometimes I've always maybe this is an English thing. I mean, I'm always struck by how abroad, as we call it, sometimes you hear of managers who are just sort of signed up to join other clubs in for the next season, but they continue and see out their current contracts, and that seems almost. And I'm sure I'm not saying it's regular, but it has happened in the Bundesliga, hasn't it? A couple of times.
Just to jump in there, of course, the famous case was Jupp Heynckes, who's at Bayer Leverkusen, who are challenging Bayern Munich for a spot in the Champions League the following year. And he knows he's moving to Bayern Munich the following year. And, you know, whenever I said, geez, isn't that kind of a conflict of interest? All the Germans are like, no, you Italians, you think that, oh, you always think the worst of people. No, nothing to see here. Move along.
I know. I mean, maybe it's a slight tangent, but I was sort of struck by that. That can happen without any the sort of, I don't know, say frenzy that we have here. I mean, I disagree with Rory's point, I think Rory and Ollie's point about the sort of integrity of the league. I mean, I think there are so many variables that just because we are two games into the season and Adam Johnson moves to Sunderland and he may play against certain teams and hasn't played against others, that makes a difference. I mean, there are so many zillions of variables in a long 9 month long season I'm not hung up on whether that's fair on Sunderland or their opponents or Man City or their opponents, but I don't think any of us feel it's entirely satisfactory that we're into the season and still debating it, and I do absolutely concur with Rory's point that as a manager you would certainly think that you would want your business done well before now, but obviously it's not managers often doing the negotiations, it's chief executives and brilliantly mastermind chairman like Daniel Levy, who has negotiated an extra 4.5p in delaying the Modric transfer by several months.
Special partnership.
Yeah, the special partnership whereby Real Madrid get three tours of Tottenham's museum for free and get to sign Gareth Bale next summer.
This is a point that's very important to our producer Chris Skinner, who of course is a big Spurs fan. He wants to know if Levy's handling of Modric was clever or not. Now, I know there's shades of gray, and so let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1, he's an absolute dolt, and 10, he's an absolute combination of Monchi and Baldini and Zork all rolled into one. Rory, your assessment?
6, because he's got 27 million rising to 33 for Modric, which is probably what Real would have paid at the start of the summer. So why is it dragged on this long? I think that's the issue. Why drag things out for what in football are relatively small amounts of money? What's the point? What's the point of waiting for an extra 500 grand when you might cost yourself half of that in league?
You realise 500 grand is more than some families make in a year, Rory.
No, but there's no point linking it to what nurses make or whatever, because it's football. It's a completely separate economy. 500 grand in football is not a lot of money.
It's not just nurses who make less than 500 grand a year.
Well, I don't know.
You realise that?
I don't know,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We had the
unless he's worried that banking the money early in the summer would therefore have Villas Boas saying, well, what great, I've got all this money to spend. So by reducing Villas Boas' chances of spending that to 4 days, maybe that. I mean,
it's not just that. It's Dicko, as you said, like when you sell big at the start of the summer, people know you're sitting on a big wad of cash, your transfer targets will get more expensive because you can't plead poverty.
But when you get 27 million quid in with 4 days left to go, your transfer the teams you're dealing with trying to replace them know that you've suddenly just got 27 million quid. And you're desperate.
Right, but they've signed players in between, like Vertonghen and Sigurdsson, before they got the cash in for Modric.
Yeah, but they will now have to go and sign players to replace Modric. There is no question about
that. Dicko, your verdict on the 1 to 10 dolt to genius scale for Modric, for the way Levy handled, himself, of course. But
I don't think he doesn't deserve a round of applause. I mean, Chelsea were willing to pay him last summer as well, weren't they? So I mean, he's got an extra season out of him. But he wants a standing ovation for dragging something along all summer and getting more or less what we expected all along. So yeah, I mean, he'd be lucky to scrape a 5 on my scale.
Ollie, your verdict, and then I'll give you my verdict on Mr. Levy.
I think in this particular instance, 5. I think he's proved a good negotiator in the past. I mean, you look at the Berbatov deal, for example, and various others. Parker and Adebayor coming in the last summer.
But
Parker
was a brilliant deal.
No, I think it was an advantageous deal, and they ended up getting him cheaper than they would have done had they gone in for him on the 1st of June.
Doesn't he have an enormous contract that they're on the hook for forever now? Three years of Scott Parker in the Spurs midfield?
The timing of the deal and the size of the transfer fee, really. But they wouldn't have got him for less than that wage-wise. But I feel in this instance, I think he's perhaps got a little caught up in how clever he is to string these things out. I think Spurs, if you look at all the potential ins and outs this week, Spurs are currently an unstable squad, and I think they could have done with an awful lot of that stability going into the season rather than going into September.
Gab, what's your verdict? We're all on tenterhooks.
Thank you. I give Levy an 8 here. I think he handled this very well. I think there are certain clubs who inflate fees, and it's great that you can say we can get 40 million if you sell them to Paris Saint-Germain or Chelsea, but there aren't that many clubs like that. You manage to sell Real Madrid a player they frankly didn't need at all. You avoided selling him to another Premier League club, which would have created problems for you. And ultimately, you got this great newfangled partnership with Real Madrid out of it, which, as somebody very cynical, was it you or was it Dicko? Which one of you? Who was the cynic who said it allows them to sell Gareth Bale to Real Madrid next year?
That was me.
That was you. Hang your head in shame. All right, time now for some quick hits. Manchester United come from behind to defeat Fulham 3-2, but Wayne Rooney gets a nasty gash on his leg, and the defense once again makes a couple big boo-boos. Ollie, what is more of a concern to Sir Alex, Rooney's absence or their defensive hiccups?
Without question, the defense. Rooney, he is a very good player for United, but with Van Persie on board, with Welbeck, with Hernandez, they do have alternatives. They don't necessarily need him at this time of season. I don't expect they'll drop too many points unless they continue to defend as they have been. I think their defense is a mess, and there's an injury crisis, but there seems to be a defensive injury crisis every season at United. It's very strange how often all of their defenders get injured.
How about you go and you interview the club's chief medical officer, since it's such an open sunshine club and so open to the media?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the kind of thing where Ferguson might say in the press conference, you should ask the doctor. And of course, the doctor has never been seen in public.
I wonder if there is a doctor, if it's like one of those like holograms, like on Star Trek Voyager.
I don't think it is.
No?
No.
Arsenal get a point at Stoke, but once again, they fail to score. Rory, what's your take on the Giroud-Podolski connection? Is sorting that out more important than replacing Alexson?
Replacing Alexson with a like-for-like midfielder is not important. Replacing Alexson with someone who can tackle properly is very important. Giroud-Podolski, I think, will take time. That's natural. We shouldn't rush it. My concern with Olivier Giroud, who seems like a lovely man, is that he has an element of the Stefan Guivarch about him.
Meaning what?
Meaning he had one good season in France, and that has masked the fact that he's only just above average.
I remember Didier Drogba only had one good season in France, so it didn't seem to do him too much harm.
Yeah, another, so there.
Another fine example.
Swansea, do it again. Two games, two wins, eight goals scored, none allowed. Dicko, how are they different this year from last season? And do you care to make a bold prediction as to when the wheels are going to come off?
Obviously, part of the obvious manpower changes and the different managers, so they're pretty different. The players are talking about a slightly more direct approach. I mean, I must confess, I've only seen Match of the Day highlights so far, but certainly Graham has talked about the instruction has been that while they want to play, keep the sort of much of the strength from the Rodgers era, they also want to say be a little more direct at times. That's been shown, I'd say, in the bits I've seen. As for how long it'll last, well, I think their pictures actually for the next month aren't too bad at all. So, you know, I don't see that there's going to be any immediate blip. Roll on that. Loudrup wagon.
Everton also make it two wins from two as they pummel Aston Villa away 3-1. Ollie, do you want to join the masses heaping praise on Davy Moyes? Or do you want to be a little more original and tell us that you're really not surprised that Paul Lambert is having such a tricky time at Villa Park?
I would normally accept any invitation to sing Moyes' praises, but I think it's more important we focus on Villa. If you look at the squad that they've got, the team that he put out on Saturday, it's just not a team that makes you think they're going to finish higher than perhaps 13th, 14th in the Premier League. They might finish a lot below that. It's a very, very weak, inexperienced Premier League squad, and although they've got some very good youngsters, they need more experience, they need more proven quality, and I think I really do fear for Villa, and they've got a good manager, but he needs to be able to invest in the squad.
I like Alamadi midfield myself, but that Ron Flaar, I can kind of see why, despite Holland having some of the worst centre halves in the history of humanity, he still couldn't get into the side on a regular basis, and despite not being a midget unlike the rest of those guys. Tottenham draw against West Brom after dominating for long stretches, but they concede a late equalisers. Rory, did Spurs deserve more? And more importantly, is Andre Villas-Boas wrong to want to banish poor old Michael Dawson from his sight?
It wasn't at the game, but from what I saw on Match of the Day, it looked like Spurs probably shaded it. But then West Brom started very well, looked well organised under Steve Clarke, and in Claudio Jakob have the best midfielder on the planet. In terms of
an excuse to praise a South American guy.
I tell you what, Yusuf Malumbu is a player as well. He's criminally underrated.
And he's not South American.
As good as Cheick Tiote.
You're supposed to be talking about Michael Dawson and why AVB doesn't like him.
I have no idea why AVB doesn't like him. I know he's got this theory that Dawson can't play in a high line, but I would have thought that at Spurs there are far bigger problems to address than whether Michael Dawson's good enough.
Stephen Fletcher and Adam Johnson for Sunderland. Not exactly cheap, but much needed reinforcements. Dicko, are they enough to push Sunderland into a European spot, given who the manager is?
Ha ha, the saintly Martin O'Neill. They're going to win the league.
He's got God on his side, the saints and apostles backing up from behind.
But no, I mean, Adam Johnson, I'm really, really hopeful that Adam Johnson, under O'Neill's brilliant managership, can become the player that he should become, which, you know, he should be an England regular starter. He's good enough. He's got the talent. He just needs the regular application. He needs to be trusted. He needs a manager who's going to be sort of on his case as well, because it's entirely sort of in his grasp to become, become an England regular. And I hope O'Neill can do to him what he did with Ashley Young, with Milner, and that's make him be as good as he can be.
And Gab, one for you. Not the best start for Real Madrid this season. Beaten at Getafe 2-1 after drawing 1-1 with Valencia. 5 points behind Barcelona. Jose Mourinho has yet to win in all competitions. What's wrong?
Well, I don't think much was wrong before this this weekend, but against Getafe, I thought they're absolutely terrible. And what's interesting to me is that, you know how a Jose Mourinho coach side will go down, will go like a goal down, and then they'll send on like two strikers, and then they'll win 2-1. And any other manager, you just say, all right, well, fine, he gambled, he felt he had no choice. You know, fair enough. With Mourinho, it's a brilliant tactical change. Well, he tried to pull one of those. They're 1-0 up, it goes to 1-1, and all of a sudden, off go come the left back and the holding midfielder. On come Callejon and Benzema. They go all out, and they give up a stupid goal because Raul Albiol isn't as good as Pepe or as mobile as Pepe. So it was disjointed. I think Mourinho carries a lot of blame for this defeat. But, hey, the good news is it's one game. He can fix it. He's smart enough to fix it, and I think they will fix it. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun, hasn't it? You had fun, Roy?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, there you go. Come find us on Twitter and share your thoughts, or you can email gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. And remember, you can go to thetimes.co.uk for your news, your gossip, your analysis, your web chats. Mine's on Tuesdays. Ollie, yours is clearly the best one of the week. What day is it?
It's Wednesday, but it might not be this week.
It's Wednesday, but it might not be. You even get the suspense of not knowing. Rory's, yours is on Monday, but that's kind of irrelevant because by the time people download this, it will have come and gone. And of course, now we've got a new and expanded and revamped game blog. And I'm coming up there, I think, Tuesday or Wednesday this week. But hey, if it's not me, it'll be somebody equally good. So never fear. Till next week. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.